Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. It's where I'll talk about the history of rugby and occasionally the other codes of football, try and challenge some of the common misunderstandings about the game's past, and also perhaps shed some historical light on present day issues. I thought I'd start at what seems to be the beginning and talk about William Webb Ellis himself. If you've ever been to the town of Rugby, you can't help but notice the fact that it's dominated by the presence of Rugby School, one of the world's most famous and prestigious private schools. Nothing symbolises this more than the larger-than-life bronze statue of William Webb Ellis that stands in front of the school overlooking Rugby's busy A428 road. In 1823, so a plaque at the other side of the school tells us, in fine disregard of the rules of football then played, young William Webb Ellis picked up the ball in the middle of a football match and ran with it, thus originating the distinctive feature of the rugby game, the plaque continues. It's a story we all know and is accepted throughout the world, not least by the international governing body of rugby union, World Rugby, who have called their World Cup the Webb Ellis Trophy. There's only one problem with this story. It's completely untrue. For a start, it isn't a statue of William Webb Ellis at all. It was only erected in 1997, and it's a likeness of the sculptor's 13-year-old son. Other than one drawing of him in middle age, we have no idea what Ellis, who died in 1872, looked like. What's more, there's absolutely no evidence that Ellis was the first person to pick up a ball and run with it. When former pupils of Rugby School set up an inquiry in 1895, they couldn't find a single eyewitness that had seen him pick up the ball. Perhaps more tellingly, they couldn't even find anyone who had been told that he had picked up the ball. In fact, there was only one person who believed that Webb Ellis invented rugby, a former pupil of the school called Matthew Bloxham. He first mentioned Ellis in a magazine article in 1877 and then again in 1880, although he also admitted that he had not actually seen Ellis pick up the ball. No one took any notice of these eccentric claims until, out of the blue in 1895, the Association of Former Rugby School Pupils, called the Old Rugbeian Society, set up a commission of inquiry and declared that the previously obscure William Webb Ellis was in fact the inventor of rugby football. He'd been framed, but why? Before we get to that question, let's rewind a bit and ask the obvious thing. If William Webb Ellis didn't invent rugby, who did? The simple answer is no one did. For centuries, people around the world have kicked, passed and carried a ball towards a goal. In almost none of these games were people banned from handling the ball as they are in modern soccer. Just have a look at films of traditional Shrove Tuesday football matches on YouTube to see what many of these games look like. Indeed, in its first few years, even the Football Association allowed players to catch the ball or hit it with their hands. After all, it's as natural to pick up the ball with your hands as it is to kick it with your feet. So the basic principles of rugby had been there as long as people had lined up in two teams and tried to score goals against their opponents. But when the Old Rugbeian Society met in 1895, the game of football had moved far away from its origins as a traditional folk custom. Britain now had two versions of the game, association football and rugby football, and there were major variations of football being played in Ireland, America, Australia and Canada. In Britain, both rugby and soccer had become mass spectator sports, played by tens of thousands of people and followed by millions more. Rugby in the north of England, South Wales and parts of the South West and the English Midlands had become the game of the industrial working class. Not only did they make the game their own, they were also really good at it. Indeed, as one former public schoolboy complained in 1892, the majority of Yorkshire 15s are composed of working men who have only adopted football in recent years and have no school education in the art. But the majority of members of London clubs have played it all their lives. Yet when the two meet, there is only one in it, the Yorkshireman. The leaders of rugby felt that they were being swamped by what they called working men players, and that they would lose control of the game they believed they had invented in their public schools. This wasn't just paranoia, because in soccer before 1885, the FA Cup had been dominated by teams of ex-public school boys such as Old Etonians and Oxford University. The only teams from industrial towns that had appeared in a final were Blackburn Rovers and their short-lived rivals Blackburn Olympic. But in 1885, the Football Association legalised professionalism in soccer, following a threat led by Lancashire clubs to break away and form their own professional British Football Association. After professional soccer was legalised, no team of privately educated players ever again played in the FA Cup final. Unsurprisingly, rugby's leaders therefore felt that the writing could be on the wall for them too. So, in 1886, the Rugby Union took the opposite path to the Football Association and declared rugby to be a purely amateur sport and threatened to expel anyone convicted of receiving money to play rugby. Arthur Budd, who would soon become president of the RFU, feared that professional rugby would mean that the middle-class amateur would become subservient to the working-class professional, thus turning the British class system upside down. He called for no mercy but iron rigour in order to throttle the hydra of the working man professional. In response, the Northern Rugby clubs began to campaign for compensation to be paid to players who had to take time off work to play the game, the famous broken time payment. But the RFU turned them down and refused any attempt at compromise. The issue came to a head in 1895, when the Northern clubs realised that the RFU was going to try and expel them one by one. And so in August 1895, the top Northern clubs met in Huddersfield to break away and form the Northern Union. But alongside the debate on broken time, rugby had also become embroiled in a culture war over the issue of who the game belonged to. Those on the side of rugby's leaders declared that the game was the property of the public schools that had nurtured it. Frank Mitchell, for example, declared, "The rugby game, as its name implies, sprang from our public schools. It has been developed by our leading London clubs and universities. Why should we hand it over without a struggle to the hordes of working men players who would quickly engulf all others?" On the other hand, supporters of working class rugby players, such as Salford's A.A. Sutherland, argued, "The prosperity and popularity of the game dates from the time the working man commenced to interest himself in it, both physically and mentally. His success at the game may not be quite suitable to the taste of the Corinthian, but it is nevertheless a fact that since he pokes his nose into the recreation, football of both codes has come on in leaps and bounds." This was not the story that rugby's leaders wanted to hear. They needed historical legitimacy to justify their control of the game. Almost all sports, not to mention monarchies, nation states and political parties, invent their own traditions about how they were born, and rugby union was no different. Originally, in books like the Reverend Frank Marshall's 1892 classic, Football, the Rugby Union Game, rugby supporters had argued that rugby was the original type of football that had been played for centuries by all classes in Britain. The name William Webb Ellis never appears in any literature at this time. But the threat of working class domination of rugby and the perception that soccer had been taken over by the masses meant that rugby union needed a new creation myth that emphasised that it was a public school game first and foremost. And so the William Webb Ellis story quickly spread around the rugby union world, giving authority to its middle-class leadership and undermining the claims of rugby league to be a legitimate form of the game. The myth had one more significant impact. By implying that William Webb Ellis was playing a game of soccer when he picked up the ball and ran with it, despite the fact the Association Code of Football did not exist until 40 years later, the story promoted the idea that soccer was the true original form of football. So by trying to invent a tradition that said rugby had always been a sport of the privately educated elite, rugby's leaders inadvertently bolstered the idea that soccer had always been the people's game. In short, the ultimate beneficiary of the William Webb Ellis myth was not rugby, but soccer. So William Webb Ellis was framed. And while this creation myth may have helped rugby union's campaign to marginalise rugby league, it ultimately allowed soccer to marginalise rugby's place in the history of sport. Which only goes to show, crime doesn't pay, especially when it comes to history. I hope you've enjoyed this first episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. If you want to follow me on Twitter, my name is Collins Tony, or one word. And if you want to know more about the topics that I'm discussing in the podcast, you can look at my website, www.rugbyreloaded.com. I'll be back next week when I'll be talking about why soccer triumphed over rugby, the story of rugby's great own goal. I look forward to seeing you next week.